Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I am your guest host, Prentice Pemberton, standing in for Dr. Woodard today. Today on Line One, we're going to look at mental health from a broad perspective. We're going to steer away from discussing diagnoses and focus more on what mental health problems look like in everyday people and what steps people can take to improve their lives. We're also going to briefly touch on how our thinking drives our behavior and can actually influence neural structure. My guests today are advanced psychiatric nurse practitioner Anne Marie Zach and Dr. Ebony McLean Owens from Bridges Counseling Connection, both of which you have been on the program before. Anne Marie is a 25-year Alaskan with over 20 years of experience as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. She's a bit unique among nurse practitioners that she provides both therapy and medications if indicated. Her practice is predominantly medical, psychiatric evaluations, psychotherapy, and medication management. Anne Marie was psychiatrically trained nurse in the United States Air Force and is particularly interested in clients who have issues related to their military services. She specializes in the treatment of mood disorders, anxiety, ADHD, and relationship issues. Dr. McLean Owens has been a therapist for 8 years and has 14 years experience in the mental health field. She specializes in trauma, anxiety, and depression, and relationship issues as well. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you having it. Appreciate you being here today. I want to remind our listeners that we can be reached with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number is 550-8433, or you can call toll-free from anywhere you may be listening at 1-888-353-5752. The last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You have to spell that out. I also want to encourage folks to give us feedback about the show or to suggest topics for the monthly mental health program that Dr. Woodard and I will be doing. All right, Anne-Marie, I'd like to start with you and just, it's a little unusual how you got your practice set up in that you do both medication management and therapy. Can you tell me a little bit about why you decided to set it up that way?
Certainly. First of all, I think that it's not that unique among nurse practitioners in this state. I do think we tend to do a little bit more one-stop shopping, as I call it. I initially was trained as a nurse. I come from a long line of nurses, and then I really enjoyed the mental health aspect of it, and so I pursued a degree in psychology. And from there, became a nurse practitioner in the state of Alaska approximately 20 years ago. At that time, I was doing a combination of medications as well as therapy, and today, now that I'm in my own practice, I just like the idea of having one-stop shopping for people, coming in, seeing the person who's going to be handling your medications, talking about the stresses in your daily life, and also working on some therapeutic approaches. I find that that works well for some, but I also find that for other clients, I do take referrals from therapists in town and enjoy just doing medications as well. So I do the broad spectrum of services at this point.
That seems like a nice setup. It's one of the things that breaks down oftentimes is the communication between the medication and the therapy. And so when you do it all in one spot, that's great. So good. Dr. McLean Owens, I can't see you. You're hidden behind
the mic.
You know
what? I was looking at that.
I don't really like it all that much. But
Should I pull this down?
That's better.
Is that better?
Give us a little bit more about your background. I didn't do you quite justice.
Well, let's see. I've been working in the field since 99, and I started out working with residential clients, with adolescents mostly. And actually, I should say I started out with children ages 3 to 5, and then all the way up until 18. So I kind of worked the whole childhood spectrum just about there. And then I went into outpatient, doing some counseling on the outpatient side, more case management, working with families. And I also did a lot of work on the medical side, medical psychology side of things, working with chronic illness patients to include HIV and AIDS patients and chronic substance abuse. It's kind of it in a nutshell before I came to Bridges.
All right. We're going to touch on a lot of topics today, so we're going to kind of start moving through these things. I definitely want to encourage, like I said before, listeners to please call in. This is an opportunity to pick the brains of some smart young ladies here and ask questions that you might have about mental health or anything, any sort of topic in general in the mental health area, and we can at least cobble together some kind of intelligent answer. And if not, we can point you in the right direction to find those answers.
Oh, you mean we won't fake it?
We won't. I don't think it's a good idea just to make stuff up.
Right. I agree with that.
According to the latest research I found in reading about all this stuff, somewhere between 26 and 32% of Americans will suffer from a diagnosable mental health or substance use disorder in any given year. That's a pretty big number. When you look at the lifetime prevalence rates, it's also interesting and really kind of eye-opening. For any mental health disorder, including substance disorders, the lifetime prevalence rate is 57.4%. So that's almost 6 out of every 10 Americans. So if it doesn't hit you, it's mm-hmm. going to hit somebody close to you, some form of mental health or some sort of problem that creates some emotional difficulties. But doesn't that kind of make it normal? I mean, if people are experiencing mental health problems and emotional distress at that level, doesn't it kind of make it normal?
Well, I would say so. I mean, I think that if you look at it, I personally believe that we all have some anxiety, some depression at some point in time in our lives, and you know, some form of mental health disorder, but maybe not truly diagnosable. And I think what makes it diagnosable is how disruptive it is to your daily living. So I would say that, you know, most of us.
I would agree. And I think, again, the cutoff for me is some anxiety is actually beneficial. If exactly. I know I have an exam coming up, I need some anxiety to get me going to study so that I don't procrastinate. However, the issue of becoming life interfering right. is where I draw the line in terms of diagnosing what's normal from abnormal. And mm-hmm. when I use the term abnormal, that just may mean how do we shore up those coping skills? How do
exactly.
we help the person learn to cope with the anxieties and the depression that come with daily living in a complex world?
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Why the stigma then? I mean, there's three of us, so one of us probably has experienced some sort of, probably Ebony.
Don't point the finger at me.
Everybody's pointing the finger at Ebony. Somebody in here, maybe all of us have experienced some sort of mental health problem at some point, but why the stigma? Why is that? I mean, because it's just like, you seem like you just, like if you're feeling bad, you just go to your therapist and, you know, like you go to your doctor when you're feeling under the weather.
Well, I think a lot of the stigma is cultural, you know, to be quite honest. I think it differs by race and ethnicity. It differs by, you know, how you're raised, because I can tell you as an African-American woman that we deal with things traditionally in the church, in the spiritual mm-hmm. realm. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of people, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of cultures that also do that. So to have to actually reach outside of that and go talk to someone, then, you know, there is a stigma about that, because there's also, I think, for a lot of families, that idea of secrecy, right?
Exactly.
What happens in our house stays in our house. You don't talk about it to anyone. And there is a stigma. You know, one of the things I find is that if anyone, you know, I would hear this from the adolescents, if someone had, you know, an emotional outburst one day, then the whole thing would be, oh, she's bipolar, right?
Yes.
She has bipolar disorder. And so I think pairing certain diagnoses with the idea that someone is crazy creates that stigma.
And I also think a lot in the media creates the stigma.
Yeah.
I mean, we rarely hear about people who have a struggle with depression,
right.
get over it, and then live a normal, healthy life. We
exactly.
tend to hear about the atrocities and the bloodshed that happens when someone mentally ill, quote unquote, goes off.
Exactly.
So I think there's a lot of extremism where a lot of people don't realize that is the extreme. That's 2%.
Exactly.
That's not the 82% of the human beings of this world that are actually functioning and doing fairly well, but may hit dips or may, what I call, hit road bumps in life. We all
right.
hit road bumps. And those are the times when we can actually intervene and help people gain that resiliency for the coping.
You know, when you talk about the media aspect, there is so much sensationalism in media. You know, we don't hear about good things that happen mm-hmm. in everyday mm-hmm. life on a regular basis. I mean, you don't hear breaking news. Someone went to their therapist today, got medication, and did fine. Right? You do only hear about it when there is an atrocity and there's bloodshed. And so that is part of the stigma. People believe that's where the whole idea of crazy comes from, right? So anyone who has a psychiatrist, because what do they always report in the media? This person had a psychiatrist, this person had a therapist, nobody put a stop to it, right? So if I'm talking to a therapist, then there has to be something seriously wrong with me. So
you're talking about not everybody who has a mental health problem is from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or Girl Interrupted.
Exactly. I mean, exactly.
Don't have to be Angelina Jolie.
You don't.
She was in that, right?
I think she was in that, yeah. Yes.
And she was a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Borderline.
But so the stigma and the association of that mental illness means you're crazy. Or if you have a depression or a rough spot or some anxiety issues or some panic, PTSD stuff, it's that there's shame. But associated or a sign of weakness, maybe?
I was going to say there's also that idea that you're weak, that you can't handle it on your own. What reasons would you need to talk to someone else? You should be able to handle these things.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps.
That's right. Get over it. Suck it up. Get over it.
And the irony in that is that I can't think of a single client that has walked into my office that hasn't jumped through every hoop they know of tried to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and tried what mommy suggested or husband suggested or daddy. They've tried all of these things, and it's, I guess, sad that it comes down to I've tried everything and now I'm so desperate that I'm willing to come in and talk to someone, and which is why I think we're here today talking about early intervention and trying to normalize walking in to talk with a therapist. I inform my clients the first session, no one ever woke up one morning and said, gee, I want to go meet a new shrink today. I'm going to go set up. You know, it's one of the hardest things that people do, but I applaud people that take that step.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you brought that up, because, I mean, I think about people coming into mental health, and I think about, you know, why do you go to the doctor? If you let your mental health go too far, it's just like your physical health. It can begin to have adverse consequences, and it compounds and gets bigger. So I think that's what you were touching on, Anne-Marie, that the importance of if something's sticking too long, if somebody dies in your family and you're stuck there for months and you just can't get over it, you know, I mean, you should get in and not suffer for a year and a half and get it worse and worse and worse.
The best example I can think of that, my marriage therapy friends, the friends that I have that do marriage therapy tell me all the time, if you suspect a couple is in trouble, get them in earlier rather than later.
That's great.
Because
example.
The prognosis of too much hurt happening before coming in leads to a much worse prognosis in terms of longevity of the marriage. So I think we can make an assumption that that's also true in terms of individual mental health.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I think when you look at it from the chronic versus acute, right? So, you know, if I have a common cold and I go in and I have an acute illness and I get medication, then I'm okay, right? But if I have a chronic illness, we need to treat mental health as a chronic illness like we treat diabetes or, you know, HIV or any of these other medical conditions where there's not that stigma. HIV there is, but with diabetes and those things. But you look at, you know, treating something and learning how to manage it over time. You know, this is a chronic condition.
I often use the diabetes one. And some mental health issues are chronic and long-term, and other ones are
more
brief
acute.
And fleeting, and they come and they go with some attention.
When I was working for Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center, I would often say, you know, I don't get a whole lot of where they would get the acute common cold. I didn't get a whole lot of that. On our end, that's the adjustment disorder, right? So I'm having something situationally happening. It's temporary. I can work through these things. So when you talked about earlier about bereavement and grief, right, I can look at that as more of an adjustment in my life if I'm working through the process of grieving. But if I can't get out of bed and it's been 18 months, you know, and I'm still grieving the person, now it's crossed into depression and it's chronic. You know, now I have to treat some of that. So,
and in fact, it's a really interesting phenomenon for me to see the whole issue of dysthymia. And by definition, dysthymia is a low-level mood that occurs for 2 years or longer.
That's right.
Now, I believe that these people are actually suffering, but this has become their new normal. And in our field, we almost wish that they would hit a major depressive episode during that dysthymia, because that would motivate a person to come in and to actually get treatment and to reset their normal back to prior to the dysthymic episode.
Right, because when you hit a new normal, you just kind of continue that. You don't even recognize that you've hit that.
Exactly.
It's for you, it's everyday living. This is just how I function. And then someone comes along and says, hey, you've got depression. And you're like, what? I don't have. I'm functioning. So
times of great suffering are simply platforms for change.
Absolutely.
I mean, it is. That is one of the best opportunities to create change when are really down, because that's the thing that motivates them. I want to take just a second. I want to remind our listeners that you can reach us with your questions or comments in three ways. The local phone number, 550-8433, or you can call toll-free from anywhere you might be listening at 1-888-5752. The last way to participate is by emailing your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. And please go ahead and call in and give us feedback and feel free to ask your questions. You mentioned something, acute versus chronic. Let's also talk about, I think one of the stigmas that, I mean, the reason a stigma gets attached to mental health is because of the severity of the stuff that we see.
That's right.
We never see the lawyers and the doctors and the pharmacists and the professionals and the blue collar workers that come into our offices and just get, you know, things kind of checked up or come in because they're having relationship problems. Let's talk about the spectrum of mental health disorders, because we only see in the media, like you pointed out, Anne-Marie, the big bad schizophrenics, bipolars, the shootings, you know, those things that come up.
And these were the exact type of clients that I worked with when I was working at Fairbanks Community Mental Health for almost 10 years. I saw people struggling with the chronic mental illnesses of schizophrenia, severe bipolar disorder, schizoaffective disorder. And when I decided to open my own practice, my practice manager sat me down one day and he said, I want you to think about something. These are not the only people suffering. And think about the corporate executive who has depression, who goes home and is drinking alcoholically at night. And he's going into this workplace and his symptoms impact family, his children, mm-hmm. His employees, his employees' families. So the rings get wider and wider and wider. So in terms of who we see, it's across the board. I mean, mental illness, depression, anxiety, these kind of diagnoses are not limited to any one part of the population.
Exactly.
I probably see more school teachers, lawyers, doctors, and professionals in my practice than anything else.
Yeah, I think the stigma comes from the homeless. I mean, the people talking to themselves. I saw a guy standing outside talking to himself and dancing and doing something. And he didn't have headphones on, so I know he wasn't, like, rocking out. And that's what we see. You don't see the other folks. So that's a good point. How are mental health problems, like, created? Where do they come from? And why is something unhealthy and something healthy? I mean, what's mental illness? Where does it come from?
Well, you know, I think that there's a whole host of factors.
That's just an easy question.
Right.
Just answer the question.
5 minutes or less.
You know, I guess the easy answer for me would be to say to look at childhood trauma. You know, a lot of times when we look at mental illness, we look at the family system first, your family of origin, right? My first question a lot of times to my clients in an intake is, tell me about the relationship with your mother, right, and your father. Mainly mother, because that's the first source of attachment. So I think a lot of times there's this disrupted attachment pattern as children. There's been, whether it's been physical or sexual or emotional abuse, you know, I think the root of a lot of mental illness, I believe that there's trauma.
I also believe that there's a genetic predisposition for many of these disorders.
True.
Mm-hmm. As well as life circumstances. Chronic mm-hmm. illness and chronic pain is a perfect example.
Oh, yeah.
You take any organism and put them under enough stress, i.e. pain, for a long enough period of time, and the chemicals in the brain do start to break down, and absolutely depression will set in.
That's great. All right. We have a caller. I'd like to go to Carl. You're online. Line one. Thanks.
Thank you, sir. Good point. Stress, I'm told, if I read the book right, it's called Stress Kills.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, especially where cardiac patients are concerned.
Yes.
The point I was trying to get at, and wanted more information on it, was how you felt, other than genetically speaking, how you felt the environment the person is raised in affects things like obesity, attitude. I know of some cases, for example, where the child grows up, gets in the middle age, and basically mimics the parent that they were had the most time with. And, I mean, when I say mimic, I mean illnesses, attitude, voice, everything.
Okay.
And it gets boiled right down to the point where it takes little or nothing to set the person off. I mean, it's one of these situations where, you know, if you leave them alone, stay away from them, well, you're wrong. You don't like me. And if you come back and try to be helpful or give them some kind of advice or something, shut up. I don't want people telling me how to run my life and the rest of it. But they will turn around and do other things that they know directly affects other people and causes them suffering and causes them heartache. I know of some people, I used to know some folks over in Government Hill, they didn't care who was in the apartment or anything else. They would not hesitate to open up windows on both ends of the building during, or both ends of the apartment during the dead of winter and just let the air come flying through there and, you know, no regard for anybody else's feelings or anything else. So they'll sit there with a blanket on, the heater going, sit right in front of the darn fool thing and complain about the heating system and the rest of it. And yet they're, the way they choose to remedy the situation is, what, downright obnoxious.
So, well, I think one of the points you're bringing up, which is a very good one, is the concept of learned behavior.
Exactly.
In childhood, who were our first models? Who were our mentors? Even in utero, there are more and more studies that are coming out that intrauterine development is very dependent on the mother's affectual or emotional state during the pregnancy. So again, we're talking about learned behaviors. There's a whole theory around depression written by Dr. Seligman, and his famous book is called Learned Helplessness. Again, it speaks to the learned behaviors in depression. Ebony?
And, you know, and just to kind of piggyback on that, we talked earlier about the genetic predisposition, right? So here you are with a mother who's depressed. A lot of times you find that there's been a history of depression with mom, with grandma, you know, and then here you are and you have this child that is genetically predisposed to your depression. And then the way that the environment is created and, you know, the way a mother copes. So, for example, if a mom who's depressed copes by sleeping all day, then guess what? That's how the child learns how to cope with depression. So a lot of times what you're speaking of is that double-edged sword of there's already genetic predisposition, and then there's that environment where the child learns how to cope and adapt in the same way that the parent does. And this is why you do get to see so many adults, you know, who have learned these behaviors from other family members.
Now, here's something that may get a little bit controversial with you, Ebony, because I'm going to throw this out.
Mm-hmm.
I get this whole topic that we're talking about right now, but I also teach my adult clients, you can't use that as an excuse to stay stuck.
Yes.
Okay? I mean, what's happened to you in childhood can be awful and may have been awful. However, once you get to be 21, 22, what are you doing to better your life? And I know I get crosshairs sometimes or go sideways with some of my therapist buddies over this.
Oh, well, not with me.
No, okay.
Because that is actually my approach. My approach is that, you know, I'm one of those people that the past has happened, right? You're going to heal from the past. You're in the present. Then what did you learn about your past that takes you to the future? What I say is, these are underlying reasons, but they're not excuses.
Awesome.
This is what I say to my clients all the time.
Yes.
They don't always love it, right? But the truth of the matter is we all have these things that have happened to us in our past that have created who we are as an individual, but we can also change it. We also have to take responsibility and be accountable for ourselves as adults because we're not children anymore.
And so. I also think that some of these things that have happened, and not necessarily horrendous abuses, but just the average kind of disappointments right. in childhood, helps build the whole idea of resiliency.
Exactly.
And resiliency is what helps us cope in adulthood.
And that's where you get into the parenting aspect, because yes. oftentimes people who have difficulty with coping and resiliency, you know, they're the kids that fell down and the parents were all over them. And, oh, my gosh, right? It's very important that when children are little, that when they have, when they bump their head and they have an accident, that you're there to support them, but that you let them know they're okay, that they are able to yes. to handle these things. And, you know, so it's really about the adult responses, you know, in children's lives. And unfortunately, a lot of times we have a lot of emotionally dysregulated adults because of the parenting as children.
And I find that in terms of our work, teaching a client to reparent themselves is
yes.
probably one of the biggest skills yes. we can help a client
nurture
with.
Nurture your inner
yes.
child.
Yes.
For sure.
Going back to what you guys said, nobody, Maria Robinson, I don't know who that is, but she said nobody can go back and start a new beginning, but anyone can start today and make a new ending.
Exactly.
Beautiful.
I love it.
Beautiful.
Carl, did we was that helpful, or did you have an additional question? Are you still on the line?
Yeah, I think that helped quite a bit. The main thing I was trying to find out was how readily it was to discern between sorting things out as to what was hereditary, what was a learned psychosis, and a few other things. And obviously, it's not as simple as some people try to make it out to be.
It is a complex mix of many factors that go into creating who we are as individuals and create our script or our story and how we interact with the world. And mental health and therapy and counseling and those sorts of things can really help sort those things out and sort of change that script a little bit. I think that's the bottom line. There is no magic bullet.
I agree. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks,
Thank
Carl.
Thank you.
All right. I got a little note here from our engineer, who said that she ought to identify, that we ought to identify our credentials. So they're just like random people just sitting up here, like talking. I thought I said Aunt Marie is a nurse practitioner, a
yes.
psychiatric nurse practitioner.
I started out as a RN, registered nurse, went for my bachelor's degree in psychology, master's degree back on the East Coast, and sat for my national certifying exam to become a nurse practitioner about just over 20 years ago.
That's not very long.
No. I'm old.
Yeah, and Ebony's got a PhD in psychology.
In psychology.
And a LPC, which is licensed
professional
counselor.
Have correct. A master's degree in clinical counseling, and my bachelor's degree is actually in elementary education.
And I am a licensed clinical social worker. I work with Ebony over at Bridges and Anne-Marie, who's in the same building, not part of Bridges, but... I think we'll probably go ahead and wrap up and take our halftime break right now. We're right up on it. So I would like to remind our listeners that you're listening to Line One, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Or you can call toll free at 1-888-353-5752 and email at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we will continue our conversation with our guests, Dr. Ebony McLean Owens, a Bridges Counseling Connection, and psychiatric nurse practitioner Anne Marie Zach. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line One, Your Health Connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line One, Your Health Connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Well, Welcome back to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your guest host, Prentice Pemberton. Joining us this week are Anchorage therapist Dr. Ebony McLean Owens and advanced nurse practitioner Anne Marie Zach. Our topic today is mental health and the role therapy can play in maximizing wellness. You can email questions at line1@alaskapublic.org, call locally at 550-8433, or toll free at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember, if you're listening between 7 and 8 on Monday evening, you will be hearing a taped recording. So if you try to call in, you'll be disappointed. All right. So we ended up the last time talking about sort of the script or the story of how we bring things with us into adulthood from childhood. You mentioned trauma, Ebony, and I don't want people to get confused that trauma is like some huge necessary. I mean, people think of trauma, they think of PTSD.
Right.
Trauma doesn't necessarily have to be this huge event. It can be a collection of small neglect, emotional abuse. I mean, not necessarily things that you think of. So just wanted to clarify that. Any other thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, what I tend to think of is that everybody doesn't have a post-traumatic stress disorder, but a lot of us will have post-traumatic stress reaction, right? So something has happened to us that may not necessarily be a huge event, but it can be something, it's how we process it, right? So if I have, you know, certain young children who are teased and bullied, don't have the same responses as other children who are teased and bullied. It's all about how I process it. So having someone say something shaming to me, even if they were to say you're fat, right, I could process that differently, and it could be a traumatic experience for me, whereas for another child of the same age, it may not have been to have that happen. So it's just really about how our brains are wired.
And that goes back to sort of the resiliency idea that you guys were talking about and how we were nurtured and how we learn to incorporate things into our understanding.
Exactly.
I think one of the best examples of that was a abnormal psychology professor that I had in undergrad. And there was probably 100 of us undergrad students in this classroom. And he said, everyone close your eyes, put your heads down. Those of you who have experienced a loss in your life, your parents divorced when you were young, put your hands up. Those of you who have experienced the breakup with a girlfriend or boyfriend, put your hands up. And he went through a list of about 5 or 6 questions, and he said, okay, now everyone put your hands down and open up your eyes. And his statement, I thought, was profound. He says, those of you who have not experienced any loss in your life up until now, to the age of 18 or 19, you're the ones that I feel sorry for. You have not had the opportunity to develop coping skills,
That's
to
right.
develop the resilience, to develop the self-soothing skills. And I took away from that class such a profound understanding of resiliency and
exactly.
what it means and how we process.
Suffering becomes bearable when it has meaning.
Absolutely. Right.
That's that's one of Viktor Frankl's things. And Viktor Frankl is one of my favorite writers. And he wrote that the only human freedom that cannot be taken from a man is the freedom to choose one's attitude of mind in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. He wrote that in Man's Search for Meaning. And that sort of sums up kind of what we're talking about here with this idea that as adults, we can begin to change and to use our thinking and our actions and our behavior in order to change our lives and our feelings, right? Is that accurate?
I think it's very accurate. I have another wonderful example of this lovely young gentleman I saw this morning, and he came in to my office, and he was quite distressed that he had applied for a job that he really, really wanted. This was his career path. And he says, you know what, Anne Marie? I know I'm changing because it didn't bring me down. What it did was it motivated me. I called up the interviewer and said, what did I do wrong? And they said, well, your resume wasn't quite up to snuff, or your cover letter wasn't quite professional, so you could tweak this and this and this. So he used that experience, which could be a negative,
right,
and he turned it around to a learning experience positive. That's someone working in therapy.
Exactly. I would agree 100%.
All right. I want to read just something real quick that I took offline, because I want to discuss the concept of neuroplasticity. And I know you guys, your eyes roll back in your head when I'm using
all these big words.
Yeah, I know. It's a big fancy word for a simple boy from Georgia, right?
Good.
Yes. And I don't know a whole ton about it, so we're not going to get too deep into it. But obviously, without Dr. Woodard here, he would help a lot. But one of the fundamental principles of how neuroplasticity functions is linked to the concept of synaptic pruning, the idea that individual connections within the brain are constantly being removed or recreated, largely dependent upon how they're used. So one way to look at this is that neurons that fire together wire together, or neurons that fire apart wire apart. So if you think about that from a, you know, every action that we do is a thought, which then creates a behavior or a, you know, a feeling. So if you start to actively concentrate on changing those automatic responses, which is another thing that I like to talk about, is automatic responses, because we can't really change the we can't control our automatic response at first.
Right.
But then what can we do once we have it? That's the question. So what do we do with those automatic responses that were sort of programmed and wired into our brains in our childhood? And what are the practices or the principles that create this sort of change?
Well, you know, I look at it in terms of behavioral change, actually, you know, in terms of doing something. Because one of the things we know is that, you know, our automatic responses, a lot of times they're habitual. It's something that, you know, it's automatic for us. It's primitive. It's something that we've always known. And if it's a behavior, it's something that we've always done. So once we have them, it's about, I know how I responded. I have people look at the consequences of how they've responded, right? And then we look at, now that you know how you've done that, how do you do it differently? Because in order to create a new response, right, that takes a lot of behavioral change. And I think that's really, for me, the key of how I start to deal with those automatic thoughts, those automatic responses, is having people focus on changing their behaviors. Because a lot of times, you know, people think about changing your thoughts to change your behaviors. But when you think of, I work backwards a lot of times. I have you just do the behavior. Because over time, if you do the behavior and you have success, then the thoughts change.
Is that like the fake it till you make it concept from...
Acting as if. I mean, if you look at it from that perspective.
But I also think biologically something's happening in the brain.
That's right.
And this is the root of cognitive behavioral therapy for me. Number one, the mindfulness or the awareness that, Prentice, you were talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And many times I'll teach clients to almost picture the good angel and bad angel is sitting on different shoulders. And to become objective observers of their stream of consciousness. That awareness is the first step.
One of the ways I have people become aware is to, when we talk about the behavioral aspect, you just do it.
Yes.
And then you record your mood after it was done.
Yes.
Right? So then they say, oh my gosh, I actually felt good after it, because they'll fight you tooth and nail on the change. Right?
Absolutely. Because what I find is that I'll have clients coming into my office wanting to figure out the whys. If I can just figure out the whys, then my behavior will change. It's like,
Yes.
People spend so much time and energy and effort in therapy learning the whys, and it gets them nowhere.
And I always tell people, why ask why?
Yes.
Because you won't answer that question.
That's right.
Why doesn't my mother love me? Why did my dad leave? Why did they treat me that way?
You will never be able to answer that question. You're not inside that person's head.
Yeah. But what you can change is the way you think about the situation
and how you respond
and the behaviors.
To that. Yes.
One of them, another Viktor Frankl quote that I really like and use in my sessions is, between a stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that sort of sums up the cognitive behavioral therapy. And my goal for people is for the automatic thoughts, because they're almost instinctual.
Mm-hmm. They're very primitive.
They're different than instinct, obviously, but they're very much automatic.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can make that gap between the stimulus and the response a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger,
right,
then they have time to sort of choose.
So teaching people how to, what I call, respond versus react, right? Because a lot of those things are reactionary. So I ask you to sit with it first, right? And for some people, that's so uncomfortable to just, when you talk about that self-awareness,
absolutely,
to just sit with it and be aware of how you feel and the thoughts that you're having. And it's very uncomfortable, because then you have to look at yourself, right? But if you can do that, then you learn you can start to learn how to respond versus reacting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that you do, Ebony, and do so well is EMDR. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about your work with EMDR in terms of changing the structure of the brain mm-hmm. in terms of that neuroplasticity.
Well, you know, I love EMDR.
I know.
I'll just start
I do
by
too.
Saying that. But one of the things I actually...
EMDR. Let's tell people what yes. it is.
EMDR is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And basically what it is it's based on the idea of the REM sleep, right? So when what I tell people often is that nightmares are not productive. Dreams can be productive, right? So if I'm having a nightmare, I'm constantly replaying something in that what we call the limbic brain where all of my emotions are held, but I'm not actually processing it through the front of my brain so that it can move out. So when we talk about dreams, a lot of times dreams are productive because you might go to bed with something on your mind and then you wake up and you have that aha, I got it, insight moment. That's a production, right? That's productive for you. The whatever's in your mind has moved through and it's been processed while you're sleeping. Well, what EMDR does is it takes that same concept of REM sleep, which what we call bilateral stimulation in EMDR, the left to right movement of the eyes, to actually get memories that have been unprocessed or that have been stuck in the limbic system where all your emotions are held, where you have that alarm that goes off in you anytime you're frightened or you're fearful. We get those memories to move to the prefrontal cortex of the brain or the processing center of the brain so that you put emotional distance. So I guess let me clarify here. If I've been really traumatized as a child, and we know that the brain forms from rear to front, right? I may have a lot of emotion stuck in my midbrain and not being able to be old enough to process those things, I would own a negative or a distorted version of that event in my head.
Isn't that a panic, anxiety? Isn't that, I mean, the idea is that memories are stored as if they are still happening.
They're still happening.
25, 30
yes.
years later.
25.
Yes.
So if I were choked and I never processed those feelings, right, then if somebody were to stick their hand close to my neck, then I'm going to jump out of my skin as if it's happening, as if the choking's happening
yes.
right there, then and there in the moment. And that's that hyperarousal center of the brain, right? So when we talk about creating those new neurons and those new pathways in the brain, EMDR helps do that because all of those stuck memories and those stuck events that people have that are related to a traumatic event can be processed fully through the eye movement, which is really phenomenal.
I have an email here. The EMDR is good stuff.
It's great stuff.
It's really
miracle.
Interesting.
It's a miracle.
Yeah.
It does some interesting stuff. I've seen some stuff that I just can't explain.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes.
It.
Oh yes.
like people who've had panic attacks for years
yeah.
and say, "Ebony, I don't need you anymore."
Because the memory remains yeah. intact.
Right.
But the emotional charge attached with the memory
to
is
it
gone.
Is removed. Right?
It's softened.
And,
yes.
and the way that it used to be is that we used to have somebody sometimes re-traumatize themselves by doing
yes.
a narrative of the same event over and over and over again in the hopes that by retelling that story, we would detach emotionally from it.
And what we learned was over the years was that we were actually
re-traumatizing many people.
Sorry.
I'm sure we could do a whole show.
I apologize.
We all do.
We could do a whole show on EMDR, and,
yeah.
And
yes.
we might. Because we did, I think you were on the show with trauma, and
right.
we touched on it, but it does deserve a whole show because it's interesting. I have an email here. It says, I have a sister that was prescribed antidepressants about 19 years ago by her gynecologist, and he continues to still prescribe to her and has never had her see a therapist. Mm-hmm. She now mixes these with alcohol and other narcotics mm-hmm. on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't all doctors require that a person sees a therapist before they start prescribing these types of meds?
Yes. Yes. Well, yes, the answer is yes, of course. However, in defense, I do see people that come into my office who are in so much distress that they're not able to get out of bed. They're not able to function on a day-to-day basis. And I may need to prescribe an antidepressant to raise their mood up enough so they can then engage in therapy. So there will be some patients that I will start on medications first. Secondly, the American Psychiatric Association has very clear guidelines on the use of antidepressants. With the first major depressive episode, if we want more than just symptom reduction, if we actually want to attempt to heal the brain, that's 1 year of treatment on an antidepressant after the symptoms resolve. Two major depressive episodes, 2 years, three or more, we would consider lifetime maintenance. But even in terms of considering lifetime maintenance, it is good practice to always give a trial off of the medications. And we can do that by slowly titrating the dose down and monitoring the mood, being ready to re-intervene with meds should the need be. But absolutely, people need to be tried off of the antidepressants just to see if their own neurochemicals have kicked in and can keep them from being depressed.
And now I think when you asked the question about therapy, we've talked about the research indicating that therapy and medication management works better than either of those two alone. Mm-hmm. I think what concerned me about, and this was an email that came through, what concerned me about that email also was that the sister sounds as if she's self-medicating mm-hmm. with, alcohol. Mm-hmm. And alcohol and antidepressants are not a good mix.
Well, first of all, what the research shows in that is if you are drinking 2 to 3 drinks 2 to 3 times a week and taking an antidepressant, what you're doing is giving yourself very, very expensive pee, because the alcohol,
right.
Well, it truly is. The alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. You're taking an antidepressant, and they will absolutely negate each other's effects.
Can you say pee on the radio?
She just did
I
that.
I hope so.
Urine.
Didn't.
Urine.
Urine. That's the technical term. All right. We got a caller on line 10. Susan, you're with us. You have a question about EMDR. I guess Ebony triggered something.
Yeah, I actually have two questions, if you can take both of them. I was told that EMDR would not be a good thing for me to go through because of this particular doctor told me it's kind of like a one event thing that it addresses, but what I have has been a lifetime of abuse by my mother and just constant kinds of stuff, and she said that sort of thing and whatever it is, I don't even know a label for what I have. All I know is that I'm on medication mm-hmm. in therapy, doing the best I can, but after 30 years in the workplace, I'm now on disability.
It's called long-term complex.
Right. It's complex trauma.
Long-term complex trauma.
And let me just go ahead and address the idea that it's a single event. I think, maybe whoever told you that, I think you said it was your doctor? Okay.
It was a psychiatrist, yeah.
Okay. And sometimes I think people are a little misinformed about how EMDR actually works, because what happens is we take what's called one negative cognition. So, for example, if you felt, I am ugly, I am bad, I am unworthy, and then we look at all of the events that are linked to that cognition. So it's not a necessarily a one event thing. It is that we are taking one cognition, and all of the events that are linked to that are lumped together by theme is really what it is. And then you take the earliest traumatic memory and you process that, and you hope that it generalizes over to all of the other memories that are linked with it. Because that's kind of how the brain, if you think about trauma, there'll be one event that someone has had that initiates this, effect of all the other events in their lives that come after this one traumatic main event are linked to it. So let's just say that if you were a child and you had been abused, right, and you had a negative, let's just say that the cognition was, I am unworthy, for the rest of your life without being able to process that, any time that you experienced those feelings or any event that caused you to experience those feelings, you're re-traumatized. And this is why the trauma is complex trauma. And so what would happen is we would take that earliest memory that you've had, and we would talk about, in brief, all of those events that are linked to that earliest memory, but we would process that earliest memory in the hopes that you would feel less emotional attachment to all of the memories that came behind it. Is that a little clearer?
Yeah, and I was just wondering, you do this kind of treatment where you are in your practice?
I do.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me where you are and, you know, how to get in touch with you and all that if I, you know, decide my doctor, you know, agrees that this kind of thing may be?
If you go on to the website, the contact information for Bridges, where Ebony works and where I work, is online there. But it's Bridges Counseling Connection where you can reach her.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
You had another quick question, or did that answer it?
It was the thing about the label for the kind of thing that I have, because people right. I trust, you know, eventually want to know, you know, am I working, you know, why are you on disability? So I usually tell them I'm bipolar, but, you know, sometimes it just seems like a label that doesn't cover everything that a person has. It's very personal. It's very individual.
Well, I would say, Susan, do some research on EMDR and talk to your therapist about it or your psychiatrist, because the EMDR is fairly new, and
right.
a lot of new sort of protocols are coming up, and it was originally sort of thought that it's associated with severe trauma like war
right.
and huge mm-hmm. natural disasters, but that's not only what it's used for, but that is sort of how it sort of came about and how it's known, I guess.
Yeah, I do have the book, I think was written by the woman who...
Shapiro.
French
yeah.
Scene Shapiro.
I
mm-hmm.
think so, yeah. Yeah, I only got as far as her working with this one woman who had been through the Oklahoma bombing.
Yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Yeah, with that issue, so that's why I thought it was sort of like a one-issue thing.
Oh, no.
As far as I got. No.
It's very effective.
Now, keep on looking and don't stop working at it, because every time you try to deal with this stuff, you're just one step closer to breaking through, I think.
Yeah.
Good luck.
Thanks.
We wish you the best.
Thanks, Susan.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Speaking of that, we're running out of time. We got like 4 hours worth of material that
we
could talk about. But I do want to... Ebony's dropping her headphones. I do want to talk a little bit about the therapy process and how does one find a good therapist? How does one know that they have a decent relationship with the therapist? What should they look for as far as finding a counselor or a med provider?
Well, I think like anything else, it's got to be a good match. And yes. it doesn't mean that it's one person's bad or the other person's bad. It's about personality and styles meshing. I think a good place to start, or at least where many of my clients start, is with their primary medical health provider. And most primary care providers in the state have a list of referrals that they tend to know these people, know their style, and try to match. The other thing is interview your therapist. Call. Look them up online. See if they're able to handle situations or they have interest in situations like you're experiencing. So I think using online and also word of mouth. Talk to friends or other people and see who they've connected with.
I would agree with that. I think for, you know, on the therapy side of things, I get a lot of referrals from my clients.
Mm-hmm.
I think once you have a connection with someone, you know, the word tends to spread and mm-hmm. people talk about you to other people, and then you end up with, you know, many friends and family members.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
In your office. But, you know, the other thing you talked about, Anne-Marie, is about having a good fit with someone and knowing that person's style. Because, you know, I joke around with people that sometimes I can tend to be too much for them, right? I can be a little in your face and those things. Some people are more quiet and some are more reserved. And so you kind of have to inventory yourself and see what your needs are, what you're looking for in a therapist, what kind of match you think you might like. And then you interview that therapist in that first session, and don't be afraid to, if it doesn't work out, to look elsewhere.
Absolutely. That's an important mm-hmm. one. Mm-hmm. You're not going to hurt a therapist. No.
Not at all.
And if you are hurting their feelings, then they're
in
the wrong business.
That's right. Pretty much.
That's right.
Because we only have ourselves. And if it's not a good fit, I mean, Anne-Marie has some other tools and toys that she can play with the medications. But, but
right.
we as
We've
therapists,
got nothing.
We got nothing.
We've just got us. That's it.
How can therapy benefit the well?
Oh, I love that question. Mm-hmm. I think that when we're well is really when we should be talking to other people, you know.
You
it's
know,
that preventative.
You know, again, I'm going to get back to my whole marital scenario. I teach my clients, we do maintenance on our cars.
That's right.
We change the oil, we bring them in to have the tires changed for front end alignment, all these other things. How often do we actually do marital maintenance?
Right.
We're not waiting until there's problems. We're maintaining it on an ongoing basis. And I think it's the exact same mm-hmm. analogy with a person's own personal mental health. How do we maintain it? And how do we reach the next level of our growth? Because growth will only stop when we die.
Exactly.
You know,
the change process is lifelong.
Absolutely.
And so you do. You want to maintain that throughout, you know, life and not wait until things get so bad.
And that also being aware that every stage of life holds its own challenges.
That's right.
You know, as we are aging.
Yes.
Those of us here that are getting older, you know.
I know. I was going to tell you, thank you for calling us young ladies.
Yes, thank you very much, Prentice. Hasn't happened in 20 years.
I'm here for you.
Thank you.
I think, you know, for the well, I mean, therapy, I mean, obviously it's something that I think most people should do if they have any sort of distress and relationships. I think your marital stuff is a great example because I call it constant corrective action
with
relationships. Yes. And if you think about a car and you're driving down the road and you wait until you're halfway in the ditch and you try to oversteer,
exactly.
You flip that sucker and there's all sorts of fire and bad stuff
Absolutely.
Going down. But if you just kind of correct it a little bit at a time, you keep heading straight on down the road with some minor hiccups.
Exactly. Absolutely. And it's the same thing that I teach my clients. I don't judge the health of a marriage or a relationship of how things are going in good times.
That's right.
I judge the health on, okay, when you're stressed, when you're having conflict, how do you resolve conflict? And how well does this couple negotiate and compromise?
Exactly.
And so, again, the couple needs to develop coping skills as each individual does.
Mm-hmm.
Anne-Marie, real quickly, since we only got about a minute left before I have to sign us out, I'd like for you to touch base briefly on when would medications be appropriate? When would you use medications in conjunction with therapy? Under what circumstances?
I use medications typically if someone is not able to engage in therapy because their symptoms are so distressing. If they're just so anxious that they can't sit still in a therapist's office or concentrate long enough to engage in the therapeutic process, we may need to use medications for the short term until they can then do the work in therapy that needs to occur. There are some other disorders like adult ADD where all the therapy in the world can give some skills,
tools.
But when there's a real brain disorder of that magnitude, then we may need to look at medications along with those tools. So I think, again, how life interfering are the symptoms and can the person and engage in therapy having these present symptoms.
And certain diagnostic presentations or categories, the best approach is medications and therapy. I mean, some of them require maintenance of medication.
Absolutely,
right?
Especially if you're looking at the chronic and severe mental illnesses, the schizophrenia, bipolar, those type of disorders. Absolutely.
Some of the ones we see in the media.
The ones that are sexualized.
Yes, exactly.
Those are very difficult. All right. Just before we wrap up here, any parting thoughts before I sign us out for you ladies?
I don't have any parting thoughts, I don't think. Do you?
Just, I think the pursuit of wellness is really what we're talking about. We've been focusing a lot on mental health issues, but I'd like to just flip that for a moment and say, you know, what we're talking about is self-actualization and how can we become as well a human being as possible.
You might be fit, but you can always be fitter.
Absolutely.
And that applies to physicality and emotional stuff as well. So my thanks to today's guest, Dr. Ebony McLean-Owens from Bridges Counseling Connections and Anne-Marie Zach. If you would like to continue today's conversation, join KSKA on Facebook. You can find the link on our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can let us know your thoughts about today's show at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We welcome any and all feedback and are especially interested in hearing your thoughts on subjects of interest for the mental health segment on Line 1. Why not tune into Your Health next week, March 25th, and my guests will be Anchorage therapist Whitney Whitman and local family law attorney Jason Sonneborn. We will be discussing the art of divorcing well as the impact divorce has on children. Pat Yack is the Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor. And audio engineer for today's show. Thanks for listening. I'm Prentice
Line
Pemberton. Have a great day.
It's a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.